From South Dakota Public Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, filling in for Lori Walsh, your host of In the Moment. And welcome to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. This week, Dr. Holm visited us to discuss his book, Life's Final Journey, A Guide for Aging and Dying with Grace. Lori talked with Reverend Hagmeyer, the new ELCA bishop, and John Schaff joined Lori for an in-depth look at Abraham Lincoln. But first, here's Way Out There by Rochelle Reiser, this week's Moment in Sound guest.
Nothing's changed here, only I have. But it looks so different when I go back. And with my eyes closed, I can still walk the floor. But I've got this empty feeling I never had before, and I'm wondering if I grew up too fast, shot up like a beanpole over my town till I was floating in the air. But when you're up so high and looking down below, it's awful cold and lonely when you're way out there. You're way different, or did I just change my clothes to something cooler than what I wore all those years ago? And am I better now, or am I just the same as the little girl who walked these halls longing for a change? 'Cause I'm wondering if I grew up too fast, shot up like a beanpole over my town till I was floating in the air. But when you're up so high and looking down below, it's awful cold and lonely when you're way out there. You're way out there. Oh, way out there. I grew up too fast, shot up like a beanpole over my town till I was floating in the air. But when you're up so high and looking down below, it's awful cold and lonely when you're way out there. You're way out. Oh, oh, oh.
That was Way Out There by Rochelle Reiser. You'll hear more from Rochelle later on in the program. But first, Dr. Holm visited us to discuss his book, Life's Final Journey, A Guide for Aging and Dying with Grace. In the book, he talks about his journey as a doctor, as a broadcaster, and as a cancer patient. He continues his battle with cancer today and continues to be a voice for science, compassion, self-care, and for hope.
This book has been wildly popular. So not only do you feel it's an urgent message, do I feel it's a great book, but readers have really connected with it and have been really kind of snatching it up in a way that doesn't always happen with important books. When you wrote this, you wrote this knowing that you had been diagnosed with cancer yourself, because it's in the introduction.
Yes.
So at least at some point before publication, you had, but you had no idea at that point what was going to happen next.
No.
In your life.
No.
Did you think about that sort of, that combination that you would talk?
Isn't that funny? I mean, I started out writing the book just before the diagnosis. And I was putting together essays and sort of my outline of what I was going to say, because one of the family physicians at our clinic came up to me one day and said, "You got to write a book for those of us who have to care for aging parents." And so that's the beginning, and I'm writing this book, and it has to do with, you know, how to stay young and healthy, how to avoid the pitfalls of aging, and by the way, we're going to all die. And I had two chapters kind of outlined already about accepting the death of a loved one, and then the last chapter, accepting your own death. And then I come down with pancreatic cancer. And I can tell you that it changed the last chapter.
Right.
And one of the interesting things was early on, I met with a good friend of mine who is a pretty famous author himself, Vijay Smith from SCSU. And he said, "Well, Rick, knowing your diagnosis, I can tell you all these things that you should do, but I think the most important thing is, get her done. Get her done before you're gone. I mean, get this book going." Yeah. And so I did. I put it in full speed and worked hard at it. Right. Got her done.
One of the reasons that you wanted to say in this book, "Hey, we're all going to die and it's time to deal with," was for physicians and for care and for people who you maybe the fear, their own fear of death, their own dread, their own panic about end of life issues might influence how they give care to others.
Well, that's really true. I mean, if you're walking in another person's moccasins, you know, and that walk has to do with facing your own dying process, that's better than if you're a person who's advising somebody who's a million miles away and they've got a problem that you'll never face. So I think physicians and caregivers need to face their own death and to escape the fear, because I think fearing death, and it, of course I think it's a universal thing, but I think fearing death is dangerous to your health. It can be harmful. And I've seen it happen. I've seen people run with panic and craze away from their own cancer and away from decent treatment that is effective, and then dying young and miserable because of their fear. You know, I think we are built to have fear to warn us that there's danger. But when the fear becomes panic and overwhelms you, and you're all you're looking at in your life is yourself, self, self, self. You lose the reality that it's not about you. That really meaning comes to life when you realize it is not just about me. It's about Lori and Dave and Tom and Cheryl. You know, those. We've got to open our heart to the reality of other people's happiness. And then it isn't money that makes you happy. It is connecting and seeing other people and being with people and enjoying their joy.
You have something to read for us today, would you?
I could do the one about God, or I could do the one about how important writing is.
We'll do both. Let's start with God. We should always start with God, right?
Okay, start with God. Let's see if I can find it. Listening to God. How do any of us cope with the catastrophes of life? Years ago, a couple faced the tragedy of an accidental death of their only young child. Even though most marriages don't survive such an insult, this one did.
Makes me want to cry,
because I watched it happen.
Between the woman and man, there was love, forgiveness, and plenty of help from the people of their church. The people of the congregation, like the wings of a mother hen, surrounded the couple with support, comfort, and warmth. Some critics of organized religion say that we are hardwired to believe in God. They say that it explains why religion exists, but not that God exists. They also point out that no society has survived more than three generations without a religious foundation, including a belief in prayer, the afterlife, and rituals. But, they say, just because we need God doesn't mean that God exists. I contend that the opposite is true, and am reassured of God's presence by the fact that we were designed to believe in God, and there are many more reasons than that to believe God exists. I'm reassured of God's presence when watching a religious-based rehabilitation program successfully help men find their way back from drug and alcohol abuse in Brookings Teen Challenge, for example. The leaders will fill a mentor's role, teach it's not about you, it is about loving others and loving God. I am reassured of God's presence when studying the wonderful complexity of the human heart and the way the heart muscle, valves, and arteries interact while sending blood with oxygen and nutrition to every cell in the body. I am reassured of God's presence when one hopeful spirit chorale sings and brings spiritual connection to the hearts and the minds and the tears to the eyes of those listening and singing. I am reassured of God's presence when a church or a mosque or a synagogue full of people saying the Lord's Prayer or any prayer in unison vibrates in synchrony with the souls of the congregation. I'm reassured of God's presence when watching a flock of birds or a school of fish move together and then change direction as if one organism, in sync by some ancient and holy spirit. As a medical doctor caring for people through the years, I have had to rely on science with which to try to help resolve the health problems people face. In caring for people, especially at the end of their lives, I've realized that often science is simply not enough. There's another place to where people need to go to help when the end is near. The spiritual realm, in my view, is all around us. If we listen very carefully for it, and this divine essence provides for many great meaning and help, we need to acknowledge the power outside of our scientific thinking. In one famous interview of Mother Teresa, the interviewer asked her how she prays. "I listen," was her response. "Well, what does God say in return?" was the next question. "He listens," was the response.
Your faith is incredibly important on your own journey as well, as well as your journey as a professional, your personal journey.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't say that my faith fits anybody else's faith. It's really kind of your own, it's a personal thing. I think everybody has to have their own personal faith, and they have to find it. And if we live in a real world and we're honest with ourselves, it's always questioning. And of course, our church gives us a foundation, but sometimes the churches fail us, and they go in a direction that is not where I would go. It doesn't mean you dump the church, you know. You just kind of know that you can't satisfy everybody, and I just encourage everybody to find a faith that's closest to their own personal faith and stay with it. The love that family had from the church and their community, outside the church too, was so important in surviving. I mean, when I lost my sister I was 16, she was 19, the family, the church, the community helped me through it. And I think I would wish everybody has that kind of connection. I think we don't emphasize connection as much as we seem to dwell on their policies and procedures and all that baloney that's not so important, really, and not the biggest part of what church is.
I want to talk a little bit about some of these end-of-life conversations, be they spiritual or with your wishes. And you're giving a presentation in November.
Yes.
And you have some questions that we can kind of go through, not to make you, you know, move around in your laptop there too much.
No.
But I think they're really valuable for people to think, not just, you know, read the book and start having these conversations, but what actually happens in some of those moments when people are facing some of those decisions, you know, times of stress.
Right. Well, we're many boomers, and even the people who are older than the boomers, you know, those people in their mid-70s to through 80s and 90s, they are coming to the time where they absolutely need an advanced directive. And of the questions that they should answer, the most important, I think, is, if I'm not aware of what's going on and it doesn't look like I have a reasonable chance of recovery, do I want a feeding tube or not? I can't say that enough, because unfortunately in our society, feeding tubes are put in, and you will drag a person through a great deal of suffering with that. Not to say that all feeding tubes are inappropriate, many are, but that many, many, many are not. And they are dragged through suffering with a feeding tube in the nose, not knowing what's going on, in a nursing home for another year or two or three. And so I think urgent message is to make a living will. So the first question is, the living will, written, signed, and notarized, is more effective than just discussing one's end-of-life wishes with your family, true or false? And the answer is, well, I'm going to ask the second question first. Imagine this situation. A patient comes into the emergency room in extremis, where the doctor in the ER is aware of an advance directive that says do not resuscitate. If the family is unanimously or even split wanting resuscitation, will the doctor do resuscitation or not do resuscitation? And the answer is, most of the time she is gonna do resuscitation. And so it isn't a great document, even if you notarize it. They made it with a lawyer. What's important is that your family hears it from you and you look at them and say, you know, it's time, don't do resuscitation. Or it's time not to put a feeding tube in if I don't know what's going on. Because that's a question that, you know, they come in with a stroke and immediately a feeding tube is placed in. Well, wrong. You know, early on, you don't want edema up there, so let them dry out a little bit. Give them 2 or 3 days. Well, the family can have 2 or 3 days of realizing this is where grandpa's going to be, and it isn't pretty, and it wouldn't be what he wanted. So I think it's really important to realize the most important thing a living will is, it's a tool for discussion with your family. And it doesn't work as well as a document than it does as a tool for discussion.
Yes, and that can be hard to hear when your parents say to you, this is what I want, because it's not what you want.
That's right.
But you're younger than they are, so you're making what you think you would want at a different stage in life.
You're 35 years of age, and your parent is dying, and you're filled with fear of death.
Yeah.
And you don't want to have dad die, and so do everything, doctor. Put in those feeding tubes, you know, keep him IV fluid filled, and shock him if he goes into CPR, and what a mistake that is.
Yeah. Making those decisions is a huge part of this conversation. Who gets to make those decisions?
Yeah.
And why do you make them, and what kind of foundation are you making them from?
Yes.
Your faith, your belief in science, your understanding of the facts, and the fact that it's not, even this most personal thing of all, is not just about you.
No. It isn't just about me. You're right. It's also about my family.
Yeah.
And so you make those decisions in accordance with their needs as well.
Yeah.
Until its suffering is too much.
All right. Let's go and have some more questions, because one of the things about this book is you have a chapter with some facts and information, diagrams, photos. Then you have some questions and an essay. So let's talk about some more questions. We were kind of on. Where do you want to go next?
Yeah. Most people older than 65, which is 15% of the population, and it's rising, have a living will, true or false?
True.
False. So the answer is this.
I was optimistic there. I was hopeful.
Hopeful.
Yeah.
Published in the July 2017 issue of Health Affairs, researchers reviewed 150 studies published between 2011 and 16 that looks at the proportion of adults who completed advanced directives. And of all the adults, of course, if you're, you know, your ability to make a decision about end of life, you know, at 18, of all the adults, only 37% of the U.S. population had an advanced directive of any kind, compared to 47% of those older than 65 years of age. That's not most. Make your advanced directive and think about it. You can document it. That's very important. And you can have a lawyer certify it, and you can have it notarized. But then if you put it in the safety deposit box, nothing will happen. You've got to share it with your family. Most important. And if you have six kids and two of them don't have the guts to let you go, then you make sure that Bob, the one who would for sure say, let him go, is your proxy. So it's important to actually have the one person who will make the decision for you if you can't. But they're not there at the emergency room a lot of times.
Right.
So the truth is you got to get them all on board. How important is a geriatrician, hospice, or palliative care nursing to be comfortable with the prospect of their own dying process?
Hmm. Well, that's you an asked important that question, yeah.
It's very important.
Yeah.
But here's the last one of the questions that I have. The most important principle in allowing a person to die is choose the best answer. Okay, Lori? Avoidance of artificial hydration or avoidance of artificial nutrition?
We'll ask the audience.
Nutrition or hydration? We've got nutrition running through the audience here. And the answer is there was a 500-pound guy who went on a 2-year fast and was still alive. All he drank was water and electrolytes. It isn't nutrition that keeps you alive. If you quit the hydration, it's 10 days. And so what happens is they hit the emergency room. The first thing the ER does is start a big IV fluid, running in full speed. And then they get to the floor. It's a stroke. We don't know what's going to happen. He's lost his swallow. He's lost all of the rest of this. Start a feeding tube. And the fluids go through the IV end of the and the nutrition through the feeding tube. Yeah, back in the day when Sir William Osler wrote an article about how people died in 1905, he found that most people went out gently. There were like 5% of the people who went out either excited and high or struggling and severely miserable. But they died a lot easier and a lot quicker in the natural way that we died, with our own endorphins kicking in, when we didn't have IV fluids. I mean, we didn't have IV fluids until transfusion started in the 20s. And then they decided it wasn't really the blood that is so important. And, of course, it's a lot easier to give IV fluids and not have to get the transfusion reactions covered. So fluids really did begin in World War I. And so since that time, now people go out, you know, they drag on. And the studies by the support study in the late 90s showed that even if you had an advanced directive, you get to the hospital and many people died suffering. 50% of them said that they were in pain more than 50% of the time. Hmm. And they're certainly dying in the ICU. They shouldn't be in the ICU. They should be in the most comfortable, open bed, families surrounding them like a campfire. But that's not what happened in the 97 support study. So I think with hospice and with palliative care, we're doing a lot better than we did before. We're still not doing very good.
Would you read for us again, please?
During the South Dakota Festival of Books, I listened to a group of 5 successful novelists discussing the art of writing and what they gained from creating those words. They all seem to agree with journalist Malcolm Gladwell, who said that it takes some talent, but more importantly, about 10,000 hours of practice to become good at anything. They each also said that writing has given them joy and humor and understanding about life and a sense about meaning. Hearing all this, I reflected on how much room I have for improvement in my own writing. On the other hand, I realized my compositions are not for a novel, but for self-help. And the goal of my last book, Life's Final Season, is to help people during their aging and dying process. As opposed to a novel, my writing has a different purpose. I also thought how therapeutic my writing has been for me since my cancer diagnosis. There's a lot out there about writing as therapy. Orthopedic surgeon David Hanscom, in his book Back in Control, provides for us a writing method to help people in chronic pain. He advises those in pain to write down any random thoughts for 10 to 30 minutes once or twice a day for at least several months. Hanscom reports the theory that when pain becomes chronic, the signals change from damaged pain actively in one part of the brain to an emotional fear and anxiety pain response in a different part of the brain. Hanscom asserts that the daily writing exercise truly helps people break the pain cycle when nothing else will help, particularly surgery. Professor Gilly Bolton also recommends a daily writing program for chronic pain. She says not to worry about grammar, style, or spelling, and advises starting by unloading and dumping negative thoughts, followed with expressive and explorative writing about any topic. She suggests focusing on the writing without distraction, finding time to do it once or twice daily. Do it for yourself, or not for others. Her contention, writing helps us illuminate our own suppressed feelings, thereby helping people deal with chronic pain, depression, and the miseries of life. I truly hope my book helps caregivers and people who are aging and dying. But my writing has had the better help for me, helping me cope with a deadly diagnosis. A daily writing exercise may just help you too.
Earlier this summer, the ELCA elected a new bishop. Reverend Hagmeier recently served as the administrative pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Madison, South Dakota, and succeeds David Zellmer. Her 60-year term officially begins September 1st. Reverend Hagmeier joined Lori in the Sioux Falls studio for a conversation.
So I have to ask, how do you develop that ability to listen to the Holy Spirit on a daily basis in ordinary life? How do you sort of help people in that process? Because, you know, people talk about being called to these big transitions, these big things, mm-hmm. but really most of us live, most of your days are not on that airplane. Most of your days are getting up and brushing your teeth like the rest of us.
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about that.
For me, I live a very disciplined life. So my days start very early. My days start as early as 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, and I use that time until the whole family gathers around the breakfast table, until 7 o'clock for personal development. So I always start out with some sort of exercising routine, depends on the light of the day, and I do have devotions and meditation built into my morning routine. So I set intentional time aside to spend with God. Now, sometimes that's very mundane, and I sit there and think, okay, are the 30 minutes over? Because it gets really long. And other days, I get lost in that time and don't really know that 30 minutes of whatever Bible study or meditation or exercising are up. But I really intentionally quiet down. I do a lot of breathing exercises that just kind of focus me on the presence of God. So for me, it's found in the quietness that I intentionally set aside, and it didn't come natural to me, But I notice that as I take that time, it helps me to interact with the people that I'm entrusted to care for, whether it is my own family, my children, my spouse, or the people I work with, or the people I meet in my daily life. And I try to take that intentionality into my day. So whether I go at the grocery store, I try to be fully present. And that's a daily practice, and it doesn't come overnight. And there are highs and lows and in-betweens, and especially when I travel, it gets difficult sometimes because we're routines are off, hours are off. But I give it my best shot, and that's all I got.
And the Holy Spirit helps. You're not doing this on your own. You don't have to force yourself into a discipline, on your own will all the time. You don't have to grit through it necessarily.
No, you don't. That's exactly the opposite. It's really all in the practice. It's just like we learn to read. We can't read the big words right away, just like I learned English. I started with Sesame Street.
Yeah.
I couldn't speak a word of English when I immigrated in 86, or when I came as an exchange student in 87. I didn't know a word of English. I could order a hamburger, orange juice, and French fries, and I didn't like either one of them. But it was words I could say. And so my teachers in Brandon helped me. So I again, there comes the theme of relationships. Yeah. For me, it's important to live in community. And as we live in community, we are stimulating each other to engage into practices, whether it's prayer or Bible study or conversations about our faith, just like we do right now. Mm.
What are some of the challenges facing the South Dakota Synod moving forward? Where do you sort of see the areas of growth that need to happen?
I think very clearly we had a very difficult year weather-wise. I come out of rural settings. I started my ministry in Wabay, South Dakota, which is we moved there after the great floods. So I have worked with people that are devastated and are wrestling with their faith and what is God up to here while we're drowning. What's God up to? And help them move through that transition. And so I was reminded this spring of the early years of my ministry. From Madison, we also commuted to Arlington, and obviously Highway 81 is flooded, and they're working on recovering that. And those pictures brought back the emotional memories. So I think for now, for me, is to be present. There's much to learn. I always say ministry happened a long time before I arrived on the scene. Ministry will happen a long time after I disappear off the scene and no one even remembers who I was. But ministry needs to happen and has happened and will happen and continues to happen. And so for me right now, the first year is spent on listening to the people I'm called to serve, to learn of their joys and their challenges at the same time. And then to care, to see where I can come in with my unique gifts to help the people that are the South Dakota Synod to be a vital and strong presence, to engage in relationships, and what do congregations need to share the good news that Jesus has hope beyond all despair. When there is water rising, who affirms them that God is still with them? What do you need as you serve in your setting that I can help provide?
Hmm. Are rural communities, thriving in their faith? Are the populations declining? How is it sort of affecting, when you're working on building those relationships, and maybe a congregation is shrinking because the young people are moving away because somebody lost the farm and now they have to go somewhere else to find work. It can be hard to be in a relationship when those things are shifting. The population is shifting. You've seen that in the work that you've done in rural South Dakota.
I think there's a few things to keep in mind. A lot of times in challenging time, at least in my faith, in my journey, in challenging times, I feel closer to God. That doesn't mean that I don't wrestle with Him or aren't angry with Him, because that's always the first we turn to are the ones that we love the most. And so we bring our despair to God, and that would be an invitation to give permission to bring our despairs to God. And then to seek partnerships amongst our neighbors. Who are there? Who is there? as much as I have a neighbor across the street, I might have another faith community that is right there in the midst of this. And how do we partner as faith communities, interfaith communities? How do we share the joys and sorrows of our daily life? So that's very important. And then I always like to remind rural communities that they have so much to offer, because they are right there on the ground in the midst of where life happens. And they do have a voice. And I would encourage those congregations to lift up that voice, to speak, whether it is joys or challenges. And then all of us need to listen, whether it's our interfaith partners, whether it is our larger congregations. How can we be intentionally in our relationships when someone is hurting, right? When someone is hurting, our call is to reach out and to show that we care, and to speak the good news and the hope of Christ's death and resurrection. There is never a new life without something else dying first. And so that's my hope as we build those intentional relationships across the South Dakota Synod and with our rural partners, that actually can happen, that community is built in the midst of decline.
When you talk about 50 years and women in justice, it's important to know that that statement was so many years in the coming, that mm-hmm. that was being talked about in ELCA before the Me Too movement, as we recognize mm-hmm. it right now as a hashtag before Time's Up. This is something the church was really working on the language of for quite some time. That sort of says something about the conversations that are happening in this group of people, doesn't it?
Yeah. I would always say the ELCA is searching and wrestling with issues before they even sometimes surface. We're not reactive. We're proactive, because Scripture keeps reminding us about those issues that will grow in our society, because we are a denomination that is firmly grounded in the world, but we're not of this world. I mean, that's, again, a very biblical concept from Paul, where he says we live in this world, but we are not of this world. But I think the foundation to all of this are the waters of baptism, where we recognize that we live in a broken world. We are broken people. And out of that brokenness, we don't need to be stuck there. We can rise to newness in life. And that, I think, frees us up to non-anxiously look at some of the issues that can cause great anxiety in our society, and that might rise up. And our conversation basis is, in my hopes and in my understanding, much different than when I just have a conversation in the civil level. Because, again, we recognize ourselves and our conversation is broken. We don't own the full truth. Only God owns the full truth. And I think that's a gift that we have been given as the church, because it creates a non-anxious room that takes the focus off us but puts it fully on the issue and where it arises from.
This week, author and political scientist John Schaff joined SDPB's Lori Walsh for an in-depth look at Abraham Lincoln. They went beyond looking at Lincoln as a talking point and explore what understanding his statesmanship offers Americans today. Schaff's new book is Abraham Lincoln's Statesmanship and the Limits of Liberal Democracy. Let's listen.
So with this book, mm-hmm. talk to me about your fascination with President Lincoln. This goes back quite some time.
It does. Well, I was a graduate student embarrassingly long ago. It was a little over 20 years ago, really. 20 years ago, I was in some way starting to write this book. And I was going to write a dissertation about something completely different. And the guy who I ended up working with as his graduate assistant, and he ended up becoming the chair of my dissertation committee, Ray Tatalovich, he said to me one time, he said, there's not enough work done in Abraham Lincoln on what we call what I end up calling in this book, the domestic side, yeah. The stuff that has nothing to do with commander in chief powers. And there's so much written on Lincoln as a commander in chief. He said, well, there's nothing really written on the other stuff. And I said, you're right. I should write that. And he said, yes, you should, which was the whole point of him bringing it up. And so I started reading and researching Lincoln as president, leading through, as I'm sure we'll get to, in the Civil War era. Not only was a Civil War fought, there are these really path-breaking pieces of legislation, some of which are very important to our part of the country, things like the Homestead Act, the Land-Grant College Act, Pacific Railroad Act. All these were passed in the 37th Congress, which is the first Congress of the Civil War, so 1861 to 1863. And then more obscure but very important things, there's a thing called the Legal Tender Act, the National Bank Act, which, as the name suggests, were more economic regulation. So there are these really big pieces of legislation. And so the question was, how does Lincoln act as a presidential leader on these pieces of legislation? And that was my dissertation. But then over time, that's really where the fascination began. The more I read of Lincoln, the more I became interested and just sort of immersed myself in it. And over a period of time, I just kept writing and writing about it until I said, I probably should throw this all together into a book, which is what I end up doing, obviously.
What's the risk of him sort of becoming so part of our daily dialogue that we lose the nuances of who he was? Like you say the word stale, like our knowledge of Lincoln has mm-hmm. become stale.
Yeah, because the book actually starts with an anecdote of sorts from the English author G.K. Chesterton, where he talks about the way to know a place is either like live there intimately for a long period of time or travel around the world and come back. So you either have to like know it really intimately or then go someplace completely different so you can compare your home to this completely different place. And so he says, you know, the worst thing is to know it well enough to take it for granted, but not well enough to know it intimately. And sometimes I think this approach to democracy and to Lincoln, that we sort of have this superficial knowledge of Lincoln. And we know like some of the big phrases from the big speeches. So people know like with malice toward none, or we hold these truths to be self-evident. Well, that's the 47 years ago, which is these truths are part of the Gettysburg Address. So we know some of these key phrases, but do we investigate him enough to really know what he actually believed and what he did, as opposed to turning him, I quote, you know, Daniel Boorstin, the historian who coined the term famous for being famous. And so we kind of turn this, not just Lincoln, but various public figures throughout history become sort of celebrities. And so the knowledge is quite superficial. And that's a danger because they became larger than life for a reason. And because we just sort of, you know, it's sort of in our blood, it's the water we swim in, we sort of lose over the course of time this sense of why Lincoln became this giant or any other of our big figures, you know, people carved on Mount Rushmore sort of thing. Why are they on Mount Rushmore? Or has it just become something that we become so used to that we don't even notice it? I think everything that Lincoln stood for, and here now more so the first half of the book, which is more, if you will, theoretical. Lincoln is standing for natural rights, which is foundational to the American Republic. Thus, you know, from the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. So equality is not anything new. He was reaffirming something there at the founding, and that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's natural rights theory. And these, I think, are the things that Lincoln was primarily defending more theoretically. And so I don't think you need to read Lincoln as breaking with the American founding. I think it's, to this extent, conserving the best of the American founding and trying to apply it to a new situation. I think the way Lincoln conceived of himself is that, as you can see this in the Gettysburg Address, that we are bringing these founding principles to life in a way they never have been, right? The intentions of the founders we can realize to a greater degree than they did. And then even when it comes to public policy, as I say, it's the third chapter in the book, you can trace Lincoln's public policy philosophy directly to Alexander Hamilton, I think. And even at the American founding, there was disagreement about this. Right. About how big a government should we have, what role should government have in promoting economic activity, to what extent should we be a mercantile financial banking nation as opposed to an agrarian nation, and that's a split that's there at the founding. Most obviously, you could put it to personalities between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. And I think with some qualifications maybe we can get to, I think Lincoln is in the Hamiltonian vein. But you can tie that to, as say, a founding father. And I don't think Lincoln conceived of himself as doing something new, of something path-breaking. And I think that to the extent that we have done things that break with the American founding, those are things that came later in American history.
Was it hard to get your mind around then sort of this concept of rule law to the point where he is talking about the legitimate legal rights of slaveholders? Mm-hmm. Well, today that doesn't really sound like a legitimate legal right to own another human being. The brutality of the slave business we know so much about. So did they.
Yes.
Help us understand this part of Lincoln.
I think there's two things. One, the rule of law. I know. I remember the first time I ever read the speech I referred to a little bit, the perpetuation of our political institutions speech. I was an undergraduate, and what my professor did when we read this, and this is quite common. In fact, I will be doing this with my own students this fall. Is you read it alongside Henry David Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, or sometimes people will read it alongside the letter from a Birmingham jail from Martin Luther King, a defense of civil disobedience. And that's one of the things that maybe rings a little bit off, because we have such a rich history in our day, just civil disobedience of people refusing to follow unjust laws, bringing about good from that. I think what Lincoln is getting at, part of it is historical, is that, and I mentioned this in the book, this was a time when mob rule wasn't a crazy threat. There were riots, there were political riots, there was a lot of political agitation, and the sense that the mob was going to get out of hand was live. And so Lincoln, you might say, erred on the other side of that, saying, no, we have to have rule of law, we have to have order. And this is, of course, one of the essential truths, I think, of politics, is that maybe people don't appreciate, is that order is very difficult to create and very easy to break. And so Lincoln is saying we have to maintain this public order. And so this dedication to the rule of law, to the Constitution, is so important, because if we lose this idea of rule of law, or what today we might call due process, right, then what, and it's part of, you know, the second half of the title of the book about the limits of liberal democracy, is that, and this dovetailing this, the second point about that, is that part of what being a statesman is this idea that the first substantive chapter of the book is these virtues of prudence and moderation. And part of what being a moderate statesman is, I define moderation, I'm stealing from Aristotle, so it's not like it was my definition, but is having each good thing in its proper amount. And in a democracy, there are various good things that we're trying to enhance, things like, what are our values? We value liberty. We value equality. We value rule of law. We value due process. We value consent of the governed. But all those things have to be balanced, because we know sometimes those things enter into conflict. So in this case, what if what the people want is fundamentally unjust? Or what if they try to achieve a just thing, but in violation of the law? This if you get into the habit of the law is too slow, the law gets in our way, the next thing you know, you've got a mob, right? And the rule of law is there precisely to constrain consent and majority rule, that you get what you want, but only if you follow a preordained process.
You're the belle of the ball, the lady of the hour, like the prettiest girl at your high school prom. You hold tight to your tiara as you dance with every boy, and you laugh like your legacy will live on. 'Cause they told you you were it, you were the next big thing, so you went ahead and cried. everyone could love. So you made yourself over. Time and time again, you will change yourself into what someone else wanted. And you'll cover every gray hair and fill in all your wrinkles, and you'll say that you did it for your people. 'Cause they told you you were it, you were the next big thing. Now they've moved on and you're still, you're calling yourself queen. But the things that made you special have been all covered up by trying to be something that everyone could love. The ones who say they miss the old you say they knew the real you, but now they can hardly recognize you anymore. 'Cause you gave yourself away to the trends and the change, and now you sit and ask yourself what for. 'Cause they told you you were it, you were the next big thing. And you hold on to that moment when they all called you queen. 'Cause the things that made you special have been all covered up by trying to be something that everyone could love. Stop trying to be something that everyone will love.
Like many young musicians, Rochelle Reiser packed for Nashville. But for Reiser, it served as a dual purpose as she sought to further her education. She talked with SDPB's Steve Zwemke during this week's Moment in Sound.
Once again, Rochelle Reiser joining us for Moment in Sound on SDPB Radio. The Next Big Thing, the name of that song. Rochelle, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So I'm interested, on your website, you have some songs there too, some really nice songs, What Was On My Mind, All In
Yes.
My Head, Daughter of the Highway, and they are listed as being performed by Rochelle Feldkamp.
Yes.
So what prompted you to change your name and go into a stage name?
Well, I think I just, really after playing shows and people coming up to me and saying, oh, you know, what's your name? Can I follow you on social media? And I would tell them my name, and I would just see complete, like, deer in the headlights look. I have no idea what you just said. And I think it was like, and you pronounced it very easily, but I mean, in other parts of the country, people don't know how to pronounce these Midwestern last names. And so I think I just kind of got tired of people not knowing how to pronounce it or misspelling it and tripping over it. And I wanted to come up with something easier, and it's been in my mind to do it for years. And so Reiser is actually my great grandma's maiden name.
Okay.
And so I really liked the sound of that together.
Cool. A couple of R's, Rochelle Reiser.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Feldkamp. That sounds so Midwest. Do you play any other instruments?
So I grew up, the first instrument that I played was piano, but I learned it classically. And so, if you give me like a Mozart piece and, you know, give it to me for a month, I can come back and play it to you. But as far as improvising, I'm not really so good at it. And then I also can play the ukulele, and I played the saxophone for 8 years in middle school and high school.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you're working on new music. We talked about the music on the website.
Yes.
Tell me about the new music you're working on. When can fans expect to see and hear something, have maybe a physical copy or at least something they can download?
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping, I'm kind of shooting for maybe next spring to have a single out. But I'm going to be recording in October, and, one of my friends, his name is Ross McReynolds. He reached out to me to produce me, and he's a drummer. And I love playing with him because it's kind of like he's just a producer by the way that he drums, that he's got it and the band can kind of follow. And so I'm really excited to work with him and get that put together.
How many pieces then in the band for your record?
Oh, well, I don't know. I feel like some of the songs will, I mean, probably be more stripped down, and, but then other ones, I mean, so much of that stuff is just kind of like, you're going to add strings and pedal steel and keys, and then you, you know, take away what it sounds too much. So I'm not really sure yet, but we'll see how it goes.
I'm interested because the first two songs you've played, you're just kind of plucking the strings very lightly, not hard strikes at all.
Yeah.
Is that the Rochelle style?
I feel like kind of, but it's funny because sometimes I'll play shows or writers rounds or whatever, and you know, someone will say to me like, "Oh, I admire your finger picking," and I'll say back to them, "I admire your strumming because I'm definitely not as good as that." So that's kind of what just comes more naturally to me. So I think I tend to write in that style for sure.
When you write music, do you write your lyrics first, or do you put music together, put chords together? How does it work for you?
Yeah, I feel like I usually do one of two things. I either start with a kind of like guitar riff, like way out there. I started with that guitar pattern and then wrote the song from there. But other times I'll write the lyrics and the melody at the same time. I usually don't, you know, just write a poem and set it to music or something. I'll be driving in the car and pull up my voice memos a lot of the time and just be singing to myself. So
I said after the first song you played, you sound a little bit like Janis.
Yeah.
What about your influences? Who you are classically trained? You played classical piano, classical voice. Was classical music a big part of your youth, or what were your influences growing up?
I mean, I don't necessarily think so. But I mean, my family was very involved in church when I was younger. So I, of course, grew up singing a lot of hymns and stuff like that. And then when I was older, I kind of got into more like 70s singer-songwriters like Carole King, James Taylor. And I also remember the first time I heard a Nat King Cole album, it like blew my mind. So I really loved like the old crooner kind of stuff too. So that was my first influences.
That's really interesting. I mean, you don't hear many young artists talking about Nat King Cole.
Yeah.
You hear Carole King every once in a while, but Nat King Cole, that's interesting.
Yeah.
We have time for one more song. What would you like to close out with?
Okay. I'll play this one. It's called A Little Bit Longer, and I wrote it about being a teenager in the Midwest.
At the end of a cul-de-sac, underneath the snowbank, we buried a childhood long gone. Behind frost-covered windows where nobody could see, we blurred the lines between what's right and wrong. 'Cause winter was a cold and terrible thing, but it's when we would huddle up under the covers, crossing our fingers for just a little bit longer, in an empty parking lot with a car that wouldn't start. Hanging in the air our shallow breathing, your freezing cold hand under my blouse. And I think that I know what you'll tell all your friends later, but I don't want to think about it now. 'Cause winter is a cold and terrible thing, it's when we all huddle up under the covers, crossing our fingers for just a little bit longer, in an empty parking lot with a car that wouldn't Oh, and if you'd ever ask me, I'd say you were my teacher, and you'd probably say I was yours too. In a cold, cold world, we kept each other warm. We were young and bored and searching for something to do. When winter was a cold and terrible thing, but it's when we all huddle up under the covers, crossing our fingers for just a little bit longer, in an empty parking lot with a car that wouldn't start. We were crossing our fingers for just a little bit longer, just a little bit longer in each other's arms.
Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org. Follow us on Instagram at sdpbinthemoment and Twitter at momentsdpb. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwempke, I'm Josh Heyer. Thanks for listening.